From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Before a tearful audience in shattered Newtown, Connecticut last night, President Obama said these tragedies must end. But how? Prominent voices from New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg to Connecticut's own Governor Daniel Malloy argue that the president should fight for stricter gun control, that America, horrified by this new massacre and mourning its young victims, is now open to this discussion. This hour on Point, our society and guns. An awful tragedy renews the call for gun control. You can join the conversation. Is this time different? Is the country ready to change? If this doesn't bring a change, what would? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Last night in Newtown, Connecticut, President Obama ended his remarks reading aloud the names of the 20 children, first graders, 6 and 7 years old, who were killed, shot to death on Friday. It was an almost unbearable litany.
Charlotte, Daniel, Olivia, Josephine, Anna, Dylan, Madeline, Catherine, Chase, Jesse, James, Grace, Emily, Jack, Noah, Caroline, Jessica, Benjamin, Avliel, Allison. God has called them all home. For those of us who remain, let us find the strength to carry on and make our country worthy of their memory.
If that list and the weeping behind it is not a wake-up call, I do not know what is. Joining me now in the studio is David Hemenway, professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health. He's written prominently on gun violence. He's author of Private Guns, Public Health. David Hemenway, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm sorry to have to be here.
Well, on this day, and yet it's important that you are, I'm glad. With us from San Francisco is Robin Thomas, executive director of the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, a national public interest law center dedicated to supporting efforts to implement smart gun laws to save lives. Robin Thomas, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
David, first to you. Help us place our society and this event in a global context, in the context of our own history. What is happening? I'm looking at this list just from 2012 of mass shootings. And, I mean, people die in many ways, but in our country, it tends to be by gun. And these are shootings. And the list goes on and on. It's just pages just in this year. And now, nearly at the end, in the holiday season, people are gathering with their families, with their children, and we see 6 and 7 year olds and the women who cared for them killed. Put this in some kind of context for us, David.
So the key thing, I think, is to realize that the mass shootings are only the tip of the iceberg, that children in the United States are being killed at disproportionate rates every day. When you compare us to the other 25 industrialized democracies, we're talking about all the first world countries. Our children are not more violent. There's no evidence that they're more aggressive. There's no evidence that there's more bullying. There's no evidence that they are more depressed. But what the evidence shows is that a child in the United States is far more likely to be killed in a gun homicide. And it's not 20% worse or 50% worse or twice as likely. A child in the United States compared to a child in Italy or a child in New Zealand is 13 times more likely to die in a gun homicide. The non-gun homicide rate across these countries, including the United States, is not very different. A child in the United States is 8 times more likely. And we're talking about 5 to 14-year-olds. This is K through 8. Mm-hmm. Is 8 times more likely than children in other developed countries to find a gun to feel bad, their girlfriend broke up with them, they're 13 years old, and to shoot themselves and die. The non-gun suicide rate among all children compared to the other developed countries is the same. A child in the United States is 10 times more likely to be unintentionally killed with a gun. We are just an anomaly among the first world countries. I teach at a public health school, and none of the students, all these international students, can understand why we don't do something, why we allow not only the gun massacres to happen, but also all these violent deaths.
So when we hear guns, you know, what is it? Guns don't kill people. Guns don't kill people. People kill people.
Yeah.
But you're saying in these ratios...
That people with guns kill people. And when you look across the United States, and we do studies where we control for... You want to control for urbanization and alcohol and crime and all these things. What you find out is children in the United States, if they live in a high gun state with permissive gun control laws, they are far more likely to die.
Even within this country.
Even within this country. So we do look at just to give you a flavor of the difference in the high gun, the high gun versus the low gun states. In the high gun states, you're 10 times more likely to die in a gun accident, 12 times more likely to find a gun and kill yourself. The non-gun suicide rate is the same across the high and the low gun states. Only 2.5 times more likely to die in a gun homicide, but that's because the crime gun, the homicide guns move, and they move from the high gun permissive states to states like New York and Massachusetts. Otherwise, we would even do better than we do here.
Robin Thomas, what has happened? I mean, I grew up with guns. I grew up in the country. And people, there would be a shotgun for quail hunting. There might be a .22 for, you know, small game. But there were certainly not assault rifles, and very few people actually had pistols. I mean, what has happened? You know, we have a long tradition of gun ownership and hunting and gun use in this country, but there's something about the number and the profile of guns we're looking at. Those that Adam Lanza took into this elementary school, none of those... No guns like that were around in my childhood when we were very familiar with guns, but this is a different profile of gun.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the guns we're talking about in these mass shootings, and as Professor Hemingway mentioned, the problem is only, you know, the tip of the iceberg when you talk about mass shootings, but that's where we get the most attention on it, so it's something that we're talking about. But certainly in these mass shootings, most of the time you're seeing these assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines being used, these weapons of war, basically, military-style weapons. And, you know, these weapons were banned in the United States between 1994 and 2004. President Clinton signed an assault weapon ban when he was in office, and unfortunately that ban expired in 2004. So in the last 8 years, there's been no assault weapon ban in place, and there's been a tremendous proliferation of these types of weapons. They've been heavily marketed by the gun industry and by gun manufacturers and promoted by the gun lobbyists. And so you have a situation where you do have tremendous amounts of these weapons. One of these assault weapons was used in this horrific shooting on Friday, and they are just weapons that enable someone to do this amount of damage in such a small amount of time. And it's incredible that we allow civilians to buy and own pretty much unlimited quantities of ammunition and these kinds of assault weapons, and there's literally almost no regulation of these guns at the national level. We do have some states, and Professor Hemingway mentioned this, that we do have better laws in some states, where in places like California, where I live, assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines are banned, and we do see lower rates of homicides and suicides as a result. But with the poorest borders in this country, you find a lot of people are able to go to the state next door to get these weapons even when they're not available in your state. So you're right. There are a lot more of these assault weapons. They are just incredibly destructive. And we absolutely need to do something about it. I mean, if we don't do something now, if there is not a public outcry demanding that, you know, this problem be addressed, I agree with you. I don't know when that time could possibly be.
We're going to hear from our listeners about what they think of this moment and our national relationship with guns. But you've followed this for a long time, Robin, and you know that in general, controls have gone the other way. They've become more and more loosened. There's, you know, concealed carry loosened all over the place. Michigan, just last week, we're reading here, you know, moving to allow concealed carry in elementary schools. I mean, the
right.
Tide's been running against gun control for a long time. You must be a realist about this. You know how deeply entrenched these interests and often attitudes are Do you see the real possibility here, or is it another one of these moments? And we've had a bunch of them where we say, oh, this can't go on, and yet it does.
You know, I think this moment is different. You're right that we've seen these tragedies, and we always think, wow, how can people not realize right now that something has to be done? But this one feels different. I think having, you know, I have a first grader, and having 20 first graders killed in their classroom just feels like a different level.
Slaughter. It's terrible. But the 11 shots in a single body. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's what decent person could be looking at this and not say, we have a moral obligation to do something. And there is so much that we can do. You know, you talked about the fact that gun laws are getting weaker, and that is true in many states. It's not true in all states. It's not true in Massachusetts. It's not true in New York. It's not true in California. There are states where you have political will, where political leaders are not being bullied by NRA lobbyists.
Colorado now, Governor Hickenlooper there saying it's time, the time is right to consider new gun restrictions. Colorado.
Absolutely. And I think that you are seeing more courage from our political leaders to take action. And I absolutely think it's feasible. I think there are places where it could be more difficult, but there's a lot of places where people are saying enough is enough. This is the time. You know, today is the day to stand up and start to do something. The president basically said as much in his speeches. He didn't offer specifics, but he certainly, to me, made it clear that he understands the scope of this problem and he recognizes that there is a need to take action.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sarah, we are asking, what now after the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut? The president says we can't tolerate this anymore. We're talking about our society and guns. David Hemenway joins us from the Harvard School of Public Health, author of Private Guns, Public Health. Robin Thomas is with us from the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence in San Francisco. You can join us. Here was the president last night at the Interfaith Prayer Vigil.
We can't tolerate this anymore. These tragedies must end. And to end them, we must change. We will be told that the causes of such violence are complex, and that is true. No single law, no set of laws can eliminate evil from the world or prevent every senseless act of violence in our society. But that can't be an excuse for inaction. Surely we can do better than this.
We can do better than this, said the president, and acknowledging what a politically thorny, difficult issue this has been, he said, nevertheless, the country must try.
If there's even one step we can take to save another child, or another parent, or another town from the grief that's visited Tucson and Aurora and Oak Creek and Newtown, in communities from Columbine to Blacksburg before that, then surely we have an obligation to try.
20 little children dead in one day, and many others, women, trying to save and protect them. David Hemenway, Robin Thomas, please stand by. I want to bring our listeners in. Sheldon in Columbia, South Carolina. Sheldon, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My prayers and condolences for Newtown in Connecticut on behalf of the citizens of South Carolina and my other homes, including Virginia, Washington State. I agree with them. I'm like you. I grew up with firearms. My dad had a shotgun and a rifle. My relatives had them. But there is a need to make a stop, like the president says. You know, there's no need for high-capacity assault weapons, like your panelist says. There's no need for recreational or to hunt with them. They fire 850 rounds a minute, semi-auto, 1,000 rounds a minute, auto. And Representative Keith Ellingson of Minnesota says he's not afraid to confront the NRA, and neither am I. I'm former, honorably discharged, three honorable from active special operations and from regular reserve, United States Air Force Security Forces, Security Police, and Special Operations.
Yes.
I see the need to confront the NRA and the gun lobby, and there's too many proliferation of firearms. There's no need for anybody to use a Bushmaster. That's like using an M16 to hunt. I might as well take an M60 machine gun or a grenade launcher That's ridiculous.
And yet it's a very, very popular weapon. Why is this weapon so popular in this country, Sheldon? You know, they just sell like hotcakes.
I mean, you can hunt with it. You can shoot with it. Recreational people like to get out there and just blast those rounds and everything. But you don't need that out in public. You don't need law enforcement, military-type weapons. What happens if they get stolen? What happens, you know?
So what should we do? You're saying then some kind of controls on that kind of weapon? Or what do you suggest, Sheldon? Here we are. The kids are dead.
You need to. I mean, they need to have a ban on them. And I mean, I'm the last person. A person like me, you would say, don't take my gun. You know, I'm a cop and, you know, and I have the right to carry it and, you know, the militia and all that. But you know what? All of those kids, if you could see it, and I'm a parent too, and I have, you know, family members that have kids, and you think about it, I'm law enforcement, but when the school says lockdown, sergeant rights don't come to the school and everything, law enforcement's got it, you've got to take a stand. The bad guys are going to have their weapons, but for an ordered society, we don't need all these assault weapons. We don't need this proliferation of firearms and everything. The president says it's got to stop somewhere. And you know what? I'm going to step to the plate and say, if I had to surrender my firearm and sacrifice it for the greater good of the public, and particularly for the kids, the future, I'll do it. Thank you, Tom.
Sheldon, I appreciate your call very much. And let us hold that perspective vividly in our minds. I want to bring on a few more callers, but Sheldon, thank you very much. Ready to do it. Kathleen in Riverside, Iowa. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to make the comment that, you know, more children are killed in cars than there are in schools, so are they going to ban cars, too? And the other thing is, the other night when I was listening to WHO radio, there was a man on named Steve Quayle who said 400,000 Russian military people are with assault weapons are in the mountains in North Carolina. So what are they doing there, and are you going to take away their assault weapons, too?
But you don't believe that, Kathleen.
Yes, I do.
Oh, my. Oh, for goodness sakes. Come on.
I'll tell you what.
Come on. Get serious. Now, on cars, listen. On cars, I agree. Cars kill a lot of people, but we have a lot of regulations around cars. Seat belts, just for starters. Could we bring in some of that sensibility to guns, Kathleen, that we've brought to cars to make them safer?
Well, Tom, you know, the bad guys always get the assault weapons. So what about the good people, and how are they going to defend themselves? And normal good people don't use assault weapons anyhow.
Well,
okay, so
what about the dead kids?
Well, the dead children, my goodness, that's horrible. But do you know how many dead children there are in this country every year from satanic ritual abuse?
Oh, okay. Kathleen, thank you very much for calling. Boy, here we are. I'm not sure where to turn here. Robin, let me come first to you. There's Sheldon in South Carolina. He's got carrying, military, police background, says he's ready to give up something here to try and get on top of this, to try and begin to get our arms around this. And then there's Kathleen, and you hear that, no, do not take away my capacity. Others are going to have the capacity to kill. Gunfired, I've got to have it too. Or, you know, how do we walk in this thicket, Robin?
Well, here's what's so incredible about this issue. Even if we start from where we are right now, you look at what is in place legally at the federal level, we have a very minimal background check system, which only applies to sales of guns at federally licensed firearms dealers at gun stores, but doesn't even apply at gun shows or to private sales. And that's basically the only regulation that we have at the national level. We don't have anything else. So even if we just start by saying, let's require background checks on all sales and transfers of guns so that we try to begin to keep guns out of the wrong hands.
And what are you
hands,
checking for there? What would be considered wrong hands?
Wrong hands would be somebody with a criminal background, somebody with violent or dangerous mental illness, somebody with a domestic abuse background. That could just be a starting point for, you know, and that is what we're looking for when we do a background check now, you know, through a licensed firearms dealer. So just doing background checks on all gun sales, and that would be a huge step in the right direction, which we don't have in place. Again, we have that kind of law in Massachusetts and California, but we don't have that kind of law.
Has that been opposed by the NRA? Has it been opposed by the NRA?
Absolutely.
Why?
Absolutely. Because they oppose every single common sense basic regulation that's ever been offered. It's how they, you know, rile up their base and make their money by opposing and creating fear that any regulation is going to lead to all the regulation. And as a result, you know, we have nothing in place. And I think it's an absurd argument. There's so many steps we can take that would begin, you know, the president said, if there's one step that we can take to save one life, how could we not be doing it? And a step like that completely undermines the argument that law-abiding gun owners who'd like to have a handgun in their home to defend themselves would have any problem getting a handgun because
universal
law background
abiding. Checks. There's one.
Universal background checks. There's one thing.
We'll look at more. David Hemenway, Kathleen says, look, cars kill people. We don't ban cars. You've also looked around the world. I mean, Australia back in 1996 had a terrible mass killing, 35 people. They acted on it. Take on the cars argument. Tell us about how other countries have addressed it. What happened in Australia?
Well, Australia, when they had their major catastrophe, their major massacre, the country decided to do something. And the reason they were able to, I think, is because a conservative stepped up and said, we are going to do something. That's what sort of we're waiting for in the United States, is for a brave conservative, a brave Republican, somebody brave from the Cato Institute to step up and say, we can actually do some reasonable things which don't take away anybody's guns.
What happened in Australia?
In Australia, they changed a lot of the gun laws to make them somewhat stronger. And what they did is they had a mandatory buyback of high-capacity assault weapons.
And in other words, if you own one, you've got to give it to the government. They'll pay you for it.
Right. And you can keep all your other guns.
Did Australians cooperate with that?
Yes, mostly they did. And the evidence—
How many were bought back?
I think 600,000.
Lots,
yeah.
Then. And this would include the kind of gun that was used in Newtown.
Yes. And the evidence is that it seems to have worked incredibly well. They had something like 11 mass shootings before the ban in the 12-year period. And since then, they've had zero mass shootings. Their suicide rates have gone down by guns. Their homicide rates by guns have gone down. And their overall suicide and homicide rates have gone down as well. It really looks like it was a very successful policy.
I mean, that's a sea change in law and, I guess, public attitude. I mean, you know, the Charlton Heston thing in this country, my cold dead hands.
Well, it's not taking away all their guns. It's taking away one specific type of gun. But other countries have had massacres, and then they have tried to do things to make it harder for people who you don't want to have guns.
We've got
to
Canada
have guns.
Right next door with a 28-day waiting period for a handgun, and this other twist there that gun buyers have to have two people vouching for them. Is that made a difference?
Well, it certainly means that it's much safer to be a Canadian than it is to be an American in terms of gun violence and in terms of lethal violence anywhere. It doesn't mean that you're not as likely to get into a bar fight or get knifed,
yeah.
But it means that you're less likely to die.
David Hemenway, Robin Thomas, please stand by. Robert Levy joins us right now from Naples, Florida. He's chairman of the Cato Institute. He's written about gun control and says gun control measures don't stop violence. Robert Levy, Bob Levy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
I know you've defended gun rights for a long time. How do you absorb an incident, to say the least, like we saw in Newtown on Friday? Does it change your mind about anything?
No, I can't say that it changes my mind. It certainly causes me to rethink all prior convictions and make sure that I'm recommending things that are consistent with empirical evidence and with constitutional law. We now have, you know, something like 250 million guns in circulation. So
yeah.
If you're going to have further restrictions on gun transactions, it's going to be a long, long time before that makes any difference in terms of the guns that are available.
True.
For these kinds of madmen. The more important point, however, is that there's no reliable evidence that suggests that increased gun control leads to a reduction in violent crime. A case in point was Washington, D.C., where I grew up and where the Heller case was litigated. There were 46 violent crimes each and every day for an entire year, and that was nearly two decades after the city enacted an outright ban on all functional firearms covering all persons in all places at all times.
I mean, fair enough, but Washington, D.C. is a little speck in this great big nation of gun ownership of ours. I mean, what about this number, you know, Bob, children ages 5 to 14, young kids, and I mean the ones who died there in Newtown were 6 and 7 years old, but children 5 to 14 in this country, 13 times as likely to be murdered with guns as in all the other industrialized country. That is a pretty compelling, terrible number, I have to say.
Well, you know, in Norway in 2011, with tight gun control and licensing, we had Anders Breivik.
But you're cherry picking, right? I mean, look at it's the overall number that matters.
Put this into perspective. These high profile and horrific multi-victim killings are a tiny fraction of 1% of all murders.
But our kids are still 13 times as likely to be murdered with guns. That's a pretty powerful number.
Indeed it is, and one must take that number into account when assessing the validity of gun control measures, but one cannot forget that there are certainly benefits that attach to the ownership of some of these weapons. Those benefits include the ability to defend oneself, the ability to hunt, the ability to participate in competition,
sure,
including Olympic competition, and the burden is on government to show that indeed gun control restrictions are likely to be effective at reducing violence. Government has not met that burden.
Well, I mean, on government, but what about all of us are involved in this? I mean, I acknowledge the recreational pleasures that many people take, the security that brings, sense of security it brings to people. But when you look at it as a public health issue overall, we just die in much greater numbers from these guns.
Well, the self-defense implications are the more important implications. We have,
but they don't protect us overall.
250 million guns in circulation.
Yeah.
There are 500,000 crimes committed with a gun each year. Now, even if you assume a different gun is used in each and every one of those crimes,
yeah,
that's 0.2% of all the guns. So any gun ban would be 99.8% over-inclusive. There are many, many more times defensive uses of these weapons than there are violent acts committed using these weapons.
David, assess
both costs and benefits in making these kinds of policy changes.
Hey, willing to do that, but the costs are weighing very heavily on our minds today. David Hemenway, in a country that has 250 million guns in circulation, if that's the right number, and everybody agrees it's something like that, you could throw up your hands and say, what's the point? There's so many guns out there already. Australia bought back 650,000. That seems huge. It would be just a little fraction of the American gun count.
Yeah, but a couple things. One is we're not talking about gun bans. There is evidence that a gun in the home increases the likelihood that there'll be a death in the home, that there'll be a murder in the home, that there'll be a suicide in the home, that the gun could be used outside the home. And this is what happened in this case. But we're not talking about gun bans. We're talking about sensible policies, as Robin talked about, universal background checks. So
but there's 250 million out there already, Bob Levy points out. So in the face of that ocean of guns, what effect does a control effort have?
Okay. I think it didn't have a significant effect. For example, living in Massachusetts, you say, where do our criminals get their guns? Where do criminals in Boston get their guns? And the answer is they are not born with them. Their parents don't have them. Where they get them is from Western Massachusetts. They get them from Vermont and New Hampshire, and they get them up I-95, the Iron Pipeline. They are brought in to the inner city by adults and sold to adolescents. The adolescents, we can stop that trafficking. It's not that hard. We could have one gun per month laws, which would have a tremendous effect on that trafficking.
Robin, how about it? You hear Bob Levy's argument. They're out there. There are rights here. There's security and self-defense here. It's kind of forget it message. Robin.
Well, as you heard Bob say, they don't actually want to talk about what steps we can take to make a difference. What they want to talk about is generalities and, I want to have self-defense. But again, as David and I have both been saying, you can address this problem without taking away that basic right of self-defense. You can have background checks. You can have assault weapons be banned and large capacity ammunition being banned. And these are basic steps that don't have any impact on those individuals who believe, and again, Professor Hemenway made the point that just because you believe you're safer with a gun doesn't mean that that's in fact the truth. But
Stand by there if you'd be good enough. And David Hemenway, Robert Levy, we appreciate your coming on for a minute here today. We're going to go to our listeners, but thank you so much for joining us with your perspective, Bob. Thank you.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking this hour, what now after the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut? The terrible, the tragic shootings. They're the president saying we can't tolerate this anymore. We're talking about our society and guns. We know what a big issue this is. We see one terrible, terrible price in Newtown, Connecticut, just right there on Friday. So what do we do? David Hemenway is with us. He's a professor at public health at the Harvard School of Public Health. Robin Thomas is with us from San Francisco, executive director of the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. The president once more here last night in Newtown, Connecticut, saying he will look for ways to bring about changes that can help stop the mass shootings.
In the coming weeks, I'll use whatever power this office holds to engage my fellow citizens, from law enforcement to mental health professionals to parents and educators, in an effort aimed at preventing more tragedies like this. Because what choice do we have? We can't accept events like this as routine.
And you hear the babies right there in that room. Their siblings may be gone. The president last night, here was New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg saying if Congress and the president stand up to the NRA right now, the American public will be on their side. Bloomberg.
Today, the NRA's power is so vastly overrated. The public, when you do the polls, they want to stop this carnage. And if 20 kids isn't enough to convince them, I don't know what would.
The NRA's power is so vastly overrated. I wonder, is it so vastly overrated? 800-423-8255. Robin Thomas, I'm just reading here right now that we've got West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat, saying that it's time to discuss gun policy. But from West Virginia, where you do not hear this, conservative Democrat there, he's saying he's on, this is on MSNBC's Morning Joe, he's a proud outdoorsman, a hunter, but this doesn't make sense. He's maybe the most prominent gun rights advocate to speak publicly in the wake of this shooting. I mean, Robin, it's been a long time since even Democrats, including President Obama, have said much about gun control.
That's absolutely right. I think that you've had a few courageous voices out there who've continued to sound the call, and Mayor Bloomberg is one of them, and Senator Feinstein's been one who's always spoken up and who introduced the first assault weapon ban and has now said on the news this weekend that she is going to introduce a renewed assault weapon ban on the first day that Congress convenes in the new session. So there have always been some voices, and I completely agree with Mayor Bloomberg. I believe the NRA's power is vastly overrated in this
last
election.
That. I mean, really, what is the evidence?
They got absolutely destroyed in this last election. Of all the money that they put in to the last election cycle, 99% of the money they spent on specific candidates went to losing races in the last election cycle. They have this, there's this impression that if the NRA is against you, that's a problem for you as an elected official, or if they're before you, that that's going to help you win. And that actually turns out to be completely false. And, you know,
isn't there a long trail of people over the year, over the last 20 years who would disagree with you having lost?
Well, I mean, I do not believe that there's a vast trail. There might be a few outliers, and they've certainly taken those specific examples and tried to prop them up as everything. But it's actually not true. If you actually look at those elections, and you know, again, who's to say that this is the issue that even affects a single electoral race? But even if you did look at it that way, it just simply doesn't hold up to scrutiny. And there's been a lot of studies done by various organizations on that. And it actually
No Democrats carried West Virginia since 88? And Al Gore, West Virginia, no Democrats carried it since Michael Dukakis in 1988. I mean, in the whole gun control issue, the NRA whipped up in West Virginia against Al Gore in 2000, lost, gone.
Well, again, and the assumption is that's what made the difference. And, you know, I would argue that it's a little more complicated than that wasn't just about the gun issue, and that, you know, there were other political issues at play there. And again, you look at what the NRA has done. They've come out really hard against Obama in both of the last two elections, trying to whip up, you know, a sense of he's going to, you know, do all the stuff on gun control, which, of course, he hasn't yet done. We're hoping that he now will take this issue up. And they haven't made one tiny dent in the president's ability to win these last two elections.
Well,
so,
we have to point out that he barely mentioned guns in the campaign. That is a political impact right there. You know, is it not?
No, you're right. He didn't actually do anything on this issue, and that has been a frustration for us. We hope that he will look at this more seriously now. But that hasn't changed the NRA's approach towards the president. The fact that he hasn't done it hasn't changed the way that they've tried to cast him and the way that their lobbyists have. So the fact that he hasn't done anything hasn't impacted the fact that they have tried to convince their members and supporters that either he wants to or that he will. So, you know, the same political division has been created by them around this, and it hasn't made any difference at all.
David, do you think we can recast this conversation? I mean, if you just keep it red, blue, Republican, Democrat, I mean, lots of people are going to be listening and thinking and searching their hearts here, even people who are very devoted to gun ownership, and wondering, is there something we need to be doing here, you know, to honor these little kids? What about it? You know, other big things have changed over time. Attitudes around gay rights have certainly changed. Attitudes around race over a great span of time have changed. Is this one where we can both honor the Constitution as interpreted and see change?
I certainly hope so. Two of the things I would argue for, which I would like to see, which have nothing directly to do with gun control. One is I would like to see a lot of hearings on this issue, commissions. When's the last time we had a commission?
To ask guns? What?
To ask, what is the role of guns in our society? What of guns? Bob Levy has made some statements which I think are completely wrong in terms of the data and the studies, but I'd like to see somebody look at that. I'd
set
like
it
to
out
see,
there so we can calmly look at it.
That's right. It's to shed light on what we know and what we need to know. I'd like to see a Surgeon General's report. I'd like to see foundations step up and say, we want to put some money into this issue to figure out what can be done. Secondly, I think what's really important is we need to change social norms in lots of ways. One way, for example, is that if you look at this specific case, this illustrates a lot of what we know. The gun in the home didn't protect the woman. It made it less safe.
This is his mother, who was a gun enthusiast.
That's right. And women in the home are particularly at risk. But the other thing is that the gun in the home is really a risk factor for suicide. We know that. And what we want to do is we've been working with gun shops and other people who really care about guns. And we're not trying to take anybody's guns away, but
are you sure about that?
People, not 99% of the people who deserve to have a gun. I want to take it away from the
deserve.
Small person.
Deserve. That's a big word.
But here's the issue that I want to be able to do is there. I want to have an 11th commandment of gun safety. Right now, in the motor vehicle area, there's this notion that friends don't let friends drive drunk.
Yeah.
In the gun area, there's no question that if you're going through a bad patch, if things are going badly for you, it's really not good to have a gun in the house. If this 20-year-old is having major problems, it's really important not to have a gun in the house while he's having these major problems.
But it's just when things are going badly, the people are the least willing to give up that gun.
That,
it's one thing to take keys from somebody who's drinking too much. Try and take somebody's gun away when they're upset.
But it's not. First, you can take away adolescents' guns. Just make sure the gun isn't there, because that's how a lot of adolescents, most adolescents who die in suicides are finding their dad's gun.
But here, he's 20 years old.
He's 20, and so it's the mother can help get the gun out of the house.
But she's the gun enthusiast. She's the one who's down at the bar talking about how she loves her guns.
Exactly. That's how social norms have to change.
Okay.
And everyone has to understand there are certain times when it's important, if you're a friend of someone, to help them get the gun out of the house. Not forever, but until a bad patch has been passed.
A change in mentality that makes – I mean, it
that
used
says
to be you wouldn't take a guy's keys away, but today you do.
You might.
And you have a designated driver today.
He appreciates
it. And everybody gets on board with it. Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Craig, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Those adults in that building had less than 5 seconds to respond to that predator. The only thing I can think of is every one of those adults needs to be armed – needs to be equipped with tasers, stun guns, mace. They just have to. We have to do something different because nothing else is working.
What are you saying? Arm them with firearms or with tasers and mace or both or what?
They have to be trained to take those out in an instant. Because nothing else is working.
Craig, I hear you. I mean, if you were in that building, if I were in that building at that moment when this was happening, I would want to be armed. I agree. But on the other hand, you know, when you think that through, if every schoolhouse in this country is full of guns, is that what you really want?
I know, I hate that. I hate that. But this is a radical thing that needs radical response. It's the only way. What else can you do?
Well, why don't we start with trying to sort of bring the temperature down, put a few reasonable constraints, have better background checks. Don't those things sound like they might help also, Craig?
It's right then and there when it happens, and you got to be able to respond. The people in the buildings are defenseless. They have to be able to have the tools to defend those children. This discussion and litigation is going to go on for months and years, and the kids still aren't protected.
Listen, I appreciate your sincerity very much. You can hear this, but I'm very skeptical about a society where schoolhouses become, armories. But I hear your desperation to protect them. I mean, David, you hear this response. We heard it. We were on live Friday night after these shootings, and it came right in from a former policeman who ran preschools in Illinois. Said, I want a gun on the hip of those teachers because you want some protection right there. But what's the evidence here? Well, I don't know.
So the problem is that the chance you will ever be able to use a gun in this kind of incident is basically zero.
Well, how many
school days and how many elementary schools are there in the United States day after day, and how many of these attacks have occurred on elementary schools? And the answer is basically you can have all these people all the time having guns with no good reason to respond to anything.
Because it's kind of like the lottery. It's terrible. I mean, it hits such a
– one person. What we do know is when you put guns into situations – it often makes things worse. And we know that when people say, I used a gun in self-defense, we've done studies on this. Most of the time, these are not what you and I would think of as self-defense, but these are escalating arguments. People get annoyed with each other. They get tired. They get drunk. And there's much more likelihood that they're going to use the guns inappropriately than that they'll have this chance to make a difference in some armed Armageddon, where someone's coming in. And that's what the evidence shows, is that where there's more guns, you have all sorts of confrontations and people die.
So we may raise the incidence of the kind of terrible situation we're trying to prevent. But you hear how if somehow we can harness Craig's determination to do something reasonable here, if we focus on this and think about it, let's think about steps that could actually bring this down. Take this risk down overall. Pais is calling from Framingham, Connecticut. Pais, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for a wonderful discussion and your guests as well. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to offer my condolences to the victims in Sandy Hook Elementary
Amen
School.
To that. Yes.
I am a mom. I have a 6-year-old, and Friday I just wanted to go to school and pick up my kid and take her home because, I couldn't stop thinking about what happened, and it was very, my stomach was hurting the whole day. It still is, actually.
Yeah.
Banning guns is necessary and absolutely has to be done and is not a right for everyone to have a gun, and it's absolutely 99% of people who are supposedly sane should not have guns, because who to say if I am an adult and I'm a sane person today that something tragic won't happen to me tomorrow and it causes me to go pick up my gun and go hurt somebody.
But Pais, you're going to tell Americans that 99% of them fully sane do not have the right to have a gun?
No, why should we have the right to have guns? I don't get it. Why?
What about the Constitution? I mean, it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court to say it's right there.
I understand that, but that was 300 years ago. Things change. Society change. Our rules have to change with them too. If we go by religion, some religions are thousands of years old. Does that mean we have to keep the same exact rules and regulations as we live today? They don't apply to us anymore. We really have to take care. And when the Constitution was written, none of these crazy weapons existed.
Pais, I respect your response as a citizen and as a mother there. This is part of the ferment that an incident like this brings to us, and there should be value in it. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Carl in Nashville. Carl, you're on.
Tom, I can say this with utter confidence because I know my country. nothing is going to get done. Absolutely nothing. Because not only do I know my country, I know my cowards. I mean, my politicians.
Six and seven-year-olds, Carl. 6 and 7 years old. Whole classrooms wiped out.
Yeah. Dallas Green's 6-year-old granddaughter was shot with Gabby Giffords in Arizona. Yeah. And he's a famous baseball manager, Hall of Fame, World Series winner. And nothing got done.
Why?
I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to tell you exactly why. My beautiful, hard-working, middle-class, blue-collar neighborhood in Chicago, where I'm originally from, is now a war zone. Park I used to walk to as a kid, a woman was found shot in the head. Outside my brother's window, someone was shot dead right there. Nothing has gotten done then. Nothing is going to get done now. What needs to be done, and this may sound horrific, grotesque, bullets do devastating things to bodies. We have no problem showing bodies overseas when they're blown up and killed. Show the bodies of victims in the inner cities and in the suburbs of America. Then and only then, maybe something to get done. But I don't have...
Carl, we're out of time right here. I don't know if I can take seeing it, but your impulse is to make us look straight at what's happened here, and that I appreciate. We're going to look here down the road. We're going to keep on top of this. Tomorrow we're going to look at mental health and murder, mass shootings, and how we care for troubled minds. Robin Thomas and David Hemingway, we're not finished with this issue after this incident. Incident seems too light a word. We will come back to it. We're grateful to each of you for being with us today. Robin Thomas in San Francisco at the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Thank you, Robin.
Thanks for having me on.
And David Hemingway with the Harvard School of Public Health. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks, Tom.
We will come back to this. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.